Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in Fort Virginia Prescott. 40,000 African Americans died fighting during the Civil War. Nearly 400,000 signed up to fight during the First World War in segregated divisions, and more than a million enlisted in World War II. Fighting for our country has often been seen as emblematic of America's best qualities, qualities like valor, courage, and a willingness to fight for American values. But history shows that instead of being honored, African American veterans have been disproportionately attacked, beaten, and lynched, a horrific trend that ran through Reconstruction, Jim Crow, and continued even after the Allies defeated the Nazis in 1945. Last year, the Equal Justice Initiative's Lynching in America, Confronting the Legacy of Racial Terror, was able to document some 4,000 lynchings throughout American history, around 800 more than previously reported. Recently, EJI released an addendum to last year's findings titled Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans. Brian Stevenson is an attorney, author, and founder of the Montgomery, Alabama-based Equal Justice Initiative. And Brian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Glad to be with you.
So this report begins with the end of the Civil War and emancipation, a war that black men actively participated in and where I mentioned 40,000 lost their lives. What was the national response to black military veterans, many of whom actually returned south after the war?
Well, I think there were two responses. I think the North largely retreated from the commitments they made to full emancipation for not only black veterans who fought for the North, but for all emancipated people. There was a Civil Rights Act in the 1870s that was designed to give black people the right to vote, protect them from violence and terror, empower them to build lives that other immigrants had experienced in this country. But all of those laws were struck down by the United States Supreme Court. The White House under Andrew Johnson was more intent on bridging gaps and mending relations with the South. And so emancipated people, including black veterans, were largely abandoned. The Southern perspective was to maintain the narrative of racial difference that had sustained slavery. And the great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude. It wasn't forced labor. The great evil of American slavery was the ideology of white supremacy, this idea that black people weren't fully human, that they weren't capable of responsibility and governance and all the other things that citizens enjoyed. And so after emancipation, there was a real need to invest in a new way in this idea that black people were inferior, not the equal of whites. And you saw that manifest with the violence, the terror, the subordination of people of color. And there was no community that was a bigger threat to this narrative of racial difference, this ideology of white supremacy, than black soldiers, people who had actually armed themselves to fight for their freedom, who showed valor and courage. And they became the primary targets of a lot of the violence and terror that shaped the collapse of Reconstruction following the Civil War.
How were you able to piece together these stories? There's so many examples and historical points that you point out in this report that show black veterans being targeted for lynchings, for beatings, for various kinds of assaults. Were you looking at firsthand accounts or newspapers? How'd you put this together?
Well, the tragedy is that we really haven't been able to put together the full story. There were thousands of people who were targeted for violence whose names and stories will never be known because they just weren't deemed newsworthy. They weren't deemed important enough to even be documented in a meaningful way. Beginning at the end of the 19th century, the public spectacle lynchings, the activity of communities to organize and gather to carry out this violence became too much of a topic for local newspapers to ignore. And so you do start to see coverage of some of these lynching events in local newspapers. That's a source of a lot of the information that we rely on for the report. There are then archival files. There was a code that forensic experts would use when they were documenting the death of a lynching victim. They would say things like, died at the hands of persons unknown, or the descriptions of the cause of death would confirm that this person had been hanged or otherwise beaten to death through mob violence. And into the 20th century, the documentation of lynching picks up. in the early part of the 20th century, the NAACP organizes primarily to detail and document these lynchings. And so the black press begins to really focus on these stories and becomes a primary source of the information that we rely on. And the later we get into the 20th century, the more we're able to then tap into oral histories and narratives from family members and community members that could detail some of these experiences.
Now, when you were looking back, were you able to find white supremacists explicitly stating that they were targeting black veterans? Or are you looking at the numbers and sort of saying, you know, all the reports of lynchings that we can find, many of them are veterans and they're being disproportionately targeted?
No, there's a great deal of evidence that black veterans were targeted. So many people were lynched in the American South, not because of an accusation of a crime, but because of some violation of a social convention. And soldiers returning from battle in their uniform would command respect. They would generate attention, as white soldiers did. And that was a threat to these narratives of racial difference, to this ideology of white supremacy. So we have accounts of black veterans being told to remove their uniforms in public or to disarm in public. There were orders issued in some communities that black veterans had to turn in their weapons. Black soldiers were told to deny their military service. And oftentimes, if there was any kind of resistance to this humiliation, that would lead to violence, and these soldiers would be beaten or lynched or victimized. So many of the accounts that we detail in our newest report are accounts that are generated by an encounter, a confrontation that was specifically about the military service of the person who then is murdered.
I'm speaking with Brian Stevenson. He's an attorney and author and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. They recently put out a report called Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans, that looks at how black veterans were targeted for lynchings and attacks from Civil War all the way up until World War II. Now, the Union Army was initially reluctant to let African Americans fight in the Civil War, and you write that that changed as casualties rose, even then under discriminatory conditions. That really seems to be a theme when you move forward and look at World War I and II.
Yeah, I think the United States government understood that empowering black people to serve in the military was going to complicate the Southern narrative about black identity. And it was an American narrative, too. I mean, we didn't in anywhere in this country fully value the rights of African Americans in the early part of the 20th century. That's why the military was segregated. That's why we didn't permit in the early goings black soldiers to fight in combat. But as the dynamics of the war became more challenging, of course, you were trying to win the war. And like what you see in contemporary athletics, I mean, nobody in the South wanted black athletes on their college football teams or basketball teams. But as you get pulled into the challenge of winning, you do what it takes. And that led to the integration of college athletics. And a similar story can be seen in the earlier history around black military service. So more and more of these black veterans were called into more demanding, more skill-specific roles. By World War I, there were fighting units from Harlem and other black regiments that were distinguishing themselves through outstanding military service and having success on the battlefield that was being recognized by Europeans and other allies that didn't make the distinctions that Americans made between black soldiers and white soldiers.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. We return now to our conversation with attorney, author, and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevenson. We're talking about EJI's new report, Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans, and the violent homecoming black military veterans have faced throughout the 20th century after combat. The prevailing narrative in American history, I think, at least from, you know, from what I experienced growing up, is to look at the end of the World Wars as these times of victory and celebration. But from an African-American perspective, that narrative is a lot more complicated, and I think these pieces often get left out of the history books or are relegated to a footnote. Tell us a little bit about the Red Summer of 1919.
Well, W.E.B. Du Bois had actually encouraged black people to join the military because he believed that it would prove to America that black people were capable of exercising other rights and responsibilities, and it would help the call for full rights, for full protection. And as black soldiers returned to the United States following military service, what it did was trigger a lot more white fears that this newly empowered, trained black community was going to be a threat. And so there was this idea that if we don't subject black people to more rigorous scrutiny and control and subordination, they're going to riot. They're going to push back. And these threats and these rumors of armed resistance to white control created a very tense moment that became manifest in the what's called the Red Summer of 1919, where white mobs would organize in response to any kind of rumor that a black person had done something threatening to a white person. And what would come as a result of these armed mobs going into the black community would be these horrific mass atrocities where dozens of people would be killed or shot or run out of town. You had whole sections of communities across the country rounded up and forced out of their areas. And in places like Elaine, Arkansas, where over 200 people were killed over a three-day period, to communities around the country, there was this tension, which very much related to black military service during World War I, which created this fear that black people were now going to arm themselves and revolt against Jim Crow and segregation.
It's hard to imagine. You know, we often think of our veterans as being asked to make a sacrifice unlike any other. It's hard to imagine deciding to enlist and potentially make that sacrifice for a country that doesn't afford you full rights. You mentioned Du Bois, but how did soldiers themselves actually view this promise of military service?
Well, I think, you know, when you're constantly humiliated, when you're constantly told that you're not really a man or you're not really a full person, where you're desperately trying to prove your humanity, it's frustrating. I mean, there's a burden that you have to manage, and it wears you down. And so I think for soldiers who then took on the double challenge of combat duty and fighting to keep America safe and free, to come home and still be treated in this way, I think psychologically it became very overwhelming for people. And you saw black soldiers doing things that other black people might not do, questioning why they have to go through the back, questioning why they can't buy a soda or coffee, questioning why they have to get off the sidewalk when other white people, many of whom didn't serve in the military, hadn't made the commitment to a freedom that they had made, walk by. And those questions would create conflict, and that conflict would create violence. And this escalation in terrorism and lynching in the early 20th century was one of the manifestations of that era. And it is terrifying. I mean, you know, older people of color today come up to me sometimes and they say, I get angry when I hear people talking about how we're dealing with domestic terrorism for the first time in our nation's history after 9/11. For that generation, it is deeply disruptive and offensive to hear us talking about this first experience with domestic terrorism when they had to survive terrorism on a daily basis. They had to worry about being bombed and lynched and menaced every day of their lives. And the growing frustration of having to live in the margins of society, having to deal with the indignation of Jim Crow and segregation, having to be minimized in all the ways that black people were minimized in this country, just grew harder and harder for those who had risked their lives to preserve this country's freedoms. And that was true after the Civil War. It became more true after World War I. And by the time we get to World War II, where there had already been activism around creating greater equality, to have those promises yet unfulfilled, I think it was really overwhelming for soldiers.
So would you say that in spite of this history and this the growth of terrorism after each of these wars, would you say that the history of African-American servicemen really did end up having a great impact on civil rights?
Well, I don't think there's any question that many of the civil rights activists and leaders that resolved to fight Jim Crow and segregation developed that resolve after serving in the military. Hosea Williams was a powerful civil rights leader who served in World War II, and his military service was key to his commitment. He came back to Georgia, was beaten by a mob of white people because he wore his military uniform, and it just concretized for him that if he was willing to die for the United States in Germany, he had to be willing to die in the United States for freedom to black people. And that will to fight, thinking strategically, thinking about the consequences of particular activities and activism, all I think shaped the civil rights movement.
We are speaking with Brian Stevenson. He's an attorney, best-selling author, and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, who recently released a report titled Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans, which takes a look at how black veterans were violently targeted from the Civil War up until World War II. Today, where we're looking at a lot of ways in which the institution of slavery, Jim Crow, how even after, you know, some of the more concrete pieces of these institutions have fallen away, that the echoes still remain today in ways that are still incredibly concrete and sometimes a little less tangible. How do you think that the legacy that this report examines, how is that factoring in for African-American veterans today? It's hard to imagine that this history doesn't still echo in our armed forces.
Oh, I don't think there's any question that this narrative of racial difference that really shapes American history is still alive, continuing to shape a range of contemporary issues. And I don't think that we're going to make the kind of progress we need to make in America until we own up to this history. Look, we're a post-genocide society. Before white settlers came to this continent, there were Native people who were thriving, and we slaughtered them by the millions through famine and war and disease, and we actually haven't acknowledged that destruction because we said, no, those Native people are different. They're savages. And we use this narrative of racial difference to justify that treatment. It's that narrative that sustained American slavery for centuries, that created this black-white divide. And in many ways, we haven't confronted that narrative. It dominates the development of the early part of the 20th century and terrorism and lynching and violence, which we have not really fully acknowledged. You know, it took us 15 years to build a memorial to 9/11 victims, which is appropriate. But we've yet to create those spaces to honor those thousands of people who were murdered during the terror acts surrounding lynching. Even in the civil rights space, I think we have been too celebratory. We haven't actually talked about the intense resistance to civil rights by state elected officials, many of whom still exercise power today, who have found new ways to resist integration. And I think there has always been a presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to black and brown people in this country. I think that presumption is at the heart of the police violence that has generated so much activism in the last couple of years. The reasons why people of color are disadvantaged and discriminated against in our criminal justice system, are at risk when they encounter the police, are targeted in our schools around these policies that create pipelines from schoolhouses to jailhouses, have everything to do with this history and our failure to acknowledge it. Part of the reason why we put out these reports is that I think there is work to be done to talk more honestly about the plight of black veterans throughout history, to acknowledge that we failed in many ways to honor and respect the service of these veterans. And when we start doing that, I really think we begin to lay a foundation that might get us to some place where we can truly claim to be free and just. But without that, we're not going to make the progress we need to make. If you go to South Africa, you can't spend time without hearing about apartheid. If you go to Rwanda, they will make you understand the legacy of genocide. In Germany, you can't go 100 meters in Berlin without seeing markers and monuments that tell the story of Holocaust victims. There is a Holocaust memorial there. In this country, we've been largely silent about the legacy of slavery and terrorism and segregation. And that silence condemns us in many of the contemporary policy discussions and debates that we have today, where race and racial bigotry and racial bias frame and shape those debates in ways that haunt us. And so, yes, I think this legacy, this history, very much is evident in the many of the issues that we're talking about today, and can only be addressed when we talk more honestly about their roots, which began with the genocide and slavery and terrorism and segregation.
Brian Stevenson is an attorney, author, and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. authors of Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans. Brian, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Glad to be with you.
You can find a link to that report and more of EJI's work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.